Hello there. Welcome to this special episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen. And as Ken says, this is a special emergency episode in which we want to focus on the implications of the Supreme Court judgment in the Rwanda case. Our guest to guide us through the issues is Adam Wagner. Adam is a public and human rights law barrister based at Doughty Street Chambers in London. He's appeared in many significant cases and public inquiries which raise human rights issues, including in the field of asylum law and the rights of immigration detainees. He's also a regular commentator on TV and radio, as well as being a prolific blogger and tweeter with some 127,000 followers. I'm also delighted to learn from his Doughty Street website that he has won the Plain English Campaign's Communicator Award for Human Rights Public Education. So, Adam, we are expecting some plain speaking from you today. Welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Adam. Plain speaking, very welcome.
As I'm sure all our listeners are aware, last Wednesday, the 15th of November, in a unanimous 5-0 judgment, the Supreme Court found the Rwanda policy in its current form and in light of the current state of the evidence to be unlawful. That is because the court upheld the view of the majority in the Court of Appeal that there are substantial grounds for believing that asylum seekers would face a real risk of ill treatment by reason of refoulement to their country of origin if they were removed to Rwanda. Refoulement is a word derived from the French refouler, meaning to force or push back. And in asylum law, it refers to the forcible return of refugees or asylum seekers to a country where they are liable to be subjected to persecution. So, Adam, the Supreme Court gave the divisional court something of a public battering, said it got the test wrong, it didn't engage with the evidence, and I think there's a sense that the hearing before the divisional court, which involved a vast list of issues, had been a somewhat rushed and messy process. Is that fair?
I was rereading the Court of Appeal judgment last night, and one of the points the Lord Chief Justice dissented against the other two justices. And one of the points he was making is the reason the divisional court may have got a little bit confused about the test for what it was meant to be doing was because there were so many, the skeleton arguments were too long and everybody and the parties couldn't even agree issues. So it seems like there was a lot of, it was very quick, but it was also very complicated. And I think that probably the courts got a bit exasperated by that.
Yeah, that's putting it politely, because one of the judges, I mean, it's a pretty fiery hearing. Lord Justice Lewis was later chastised, I think, for his behaviour towards counsel during that case, which is a very unusual circumstance. But as you say, the skeleton arguments were extremely long, and that may have led to some problems in itself.
Yeah, you're right. That's but you're right on both points.
Yeah, but I mean, I know from speaking to some of the lawyers who were involved that the whole process was far too rushed and compressed into too short a period of time, given the range of issues.
But Tim, that was the judge's fault, wasn't it? The judges were very concerned to get the thing through with what I think all of us looking at it in retrospect would say was really unseemly haste.
Absolutely, quite right. But I mean, let's cut to the chase perhaps and try and simplify it. So the central issue was, when it reached the Supreme Court, was the Home Secretary's conclusion that Rwanda was a safe third country to send people to have their asylum claims processed? Was that conclusion by the Home Secretary legally flawed? And ultimately, the Court of Appeal allowed the appeal on that ground. They overturned the divisional court's finding that it was, by 2-1, as you say, with the Lord Chief Justice dissenting and the Master of the Rolls and Lord Justice Underhill in the majority. And then the Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court then dismissed the Secretary of State's appeal in what I thought was very clear, very robust terms, and strongly critical. I mean, very, very critical of the approach of the divisional court to its central role of assessing the evidence about whether Rwanda was a safe third country. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I describe the judgment is that there was a sort of main plot and there were a number of subplots. And I think that the main plot was actually quite a straightforward application of a legal principle that requires assessment of the factual situation on the ground in Rwanda. One of the interesting things that I think was mentioned in one of the judgments is What would usually happen when the courts need to assess whether a country is safe to send people back to? There'll be what's called a country guidance decision by the upper tribunal. And the upper tribunal, I mean, I used to do quite a lot of this work, and these it's a completely, you know, standard procedure. What will happen is the upper tribunal will sit for a number of weeks, something like it can be up to about 6 weeks. They'll hear evidence from the UNHCR, from country experts, from the Secretary of State's experts, and they'll and the issues will be: is there a, you know, in this case, is there a real risk of refoulement? Is there political interference in the courts? Is there, you know, is there a real risk of people being subjected to inhuman and degrading treatment? And that's given a, you know, if you imagine, it's given a huge amount of court time and primary factual evidence. There'll be cross-examination, and the court will then come up with a judgment, which is usually running into hundreds and hundreds of paragraphs. It's sort of a report, effectively, on the country. And that country guidance case will then become the authoritative guidance, both for the Secretary of State in making decisions and for courts in deciding appeals. And here, this was done through the quite unwieldy process of judicial review, which isn't really set up, as we all know, for these detailed factual considerations. And I think that's where, that's one of the subplots that I think is really important, because that's where I think the divisional court became a bit unwound, because they were dealing with this and the Supreme Court to be fair to the divisional court, they were dealing with a lot of issues, and they had to, and the actual factual analysis part of the judgment in relation to this issue was only one part of the judgment. But they didn't have the benefit of evidence.
But you say that, but nonetheless, the terms of the judgment of the Supreme Court are very, very strongly critical of the approach of the divisional court.
Oh yeah, so that's the starting point, not the end point. The language that the Supreme Court uses is really scathing. I mean, really, really difficult for the divisional court judges. And I also thought, you know, They use the word dismissive a number of times, that the divisional court was overly dismissive, and particularly of the UNHCR evidence. And I noticed when Lord Reed, I was watching Lord Reed give his summary of the judgment, and that the things he emphasized were very interesting. He emphasized, first of all, what the policy really is about. Second of all, that it's not just a human rights case, that the principle of non-refoulement is fundamental in lots of other ways, international and domestic law. And the third thing he did was say the UNHCR is a subject matter expert and needs to be listened to very carefully. And I think that one of the subplots going on is that the UNHCR was effectively treated by the divisional court, and indeed in partly by the Lord Chief Justice as well, but though he sort of gets away with it in the judgment, as a skewed actor. As an actor which had
an agenda,
ulterior motives for presenting the evidence in the way it did.
There's a strong political view, isn't there, on the right, that's the position, and it seems sometimes to be reflected that view in the views of some of the judges. I mean, I've heard that the divisional court was a bit like the bad old days, judges from the bad old days, behaving in a rather overbearing and bullying manner. But one of the things that interests me about the Supreme Court judgment is this: the Supreme Court has changed, as we've discussed a number of times on this podcast. It's shifted since the days of David Neuberger and Brenda Hale, and the Reed Court is much more deferential to the government on policy matters. And David Alan Green, the Financial Times legal commentator, has pointed out that if the government can't win on a policy matter in front of this Supreme Court, it's going to struggle to win anywhere. And there's something in that, isn't there? I mean, this court is much more deferential to the government on questions of policy than the Hale Court or the Neuberger Court were. And yet the government lost, as Tim says, comprehensively and resoundingly on this question. Can we just deal with one other aspect of this judgment, which I think is politically extremely important, because the political right, and Suella Braverman in particular, tried to make this all about the European Convention on Human Rights and how we're being prevented from doing this by the European Convention. It's stopping us doing what we want. It's a criminal's charter. we can't get people on the planes to Rwanda because of the ECHR. Lord Reed went out of his way at an early stage in his judgment to say, in effect, this is not about the European Convention. It's about a whole myriad of international treaties that we're involved in, international conventions that we've signed, and of course, repeated domestic law, which has recognized the principle which the Supreme Court upheld. And this is, if we left the European Convention on Human Rights tomorrow, as Jonathan Sumption has pointed out, this policy would still be unlawful under our current domestic law. I mean, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, and I thought that was a very clear shot across the bows, and it was also something he emphasized in his public statement. And I think I my interpretation of what's going on there, and that's another subplot, is that this policy was always a sort of seen as a win-win for people like Suella Braverman, who wants to leave the ECHR, because either they succeed on the policy and therefore they get to send people to Rwanda and it works in their view, or they don't succeed because the courts say, and ideally Strasbourg says, you can't do it. And then they get their wider aim. They achieve their wider aim, which is convincing the public that it's time to leave the convention because it's stopping us controlling our borders. And I think that is, I think the courts, the Supreme Court did not like that at all, and doesn't, and perhaps doesn't, feels that it's being politicized in that sense. And that's what that's all about. It's that this isn't a human rights case. You know, it, a bit like when they say this isn't, they you know, when the Supreme Court wants to set a point of principle, it usually says this is about the common law. This isn't about human rights. You know, in those cases about open justice or about the right to not to be unlawfully detained, those sorts of cases. So I think there's a lot going on there.
Well, let's move on to how the government has reacted to this resounding defeat before the Supreme Court, and whether the suggested responses to it are really going to work. So while saying that they respect the Supreme Court's ruling, the government's response has been extraordinarily defiant, and there are really two aspects to it. Firstly, the suggestion is that, and James Cleverly in his interview on the Today programme the other day suggested that, you know, Plan B has been in operation or has been working away behind the scenes for some months, which is to devise a new treaty with Rwanda to replace the current Memorandum of Understanding, which is the basis for the arrangement with Rwanda. And then in addition, they're suggesting that there'll be an emergency bill before Parliament which will somehow declare Rwanda to be safe and thereby prevent further court challenges under UK law. So can we just focus on that, Adam? Firstly, this idea of a new treaty. I don't see how a new treaty is going to ultimately make any difference in the face of the Supreme Court's very detailed findings and the Court of Appeal majority findings about the fact is that Rwanda does not comply with, does not fulfil its treaty obligations.
Yeah, and that's the killer point about the treaty, isn't it? That you can't, you know, if you compare it to Al Othman, the Abu Qatada case, in that case they succeeded by changing with a treaty. Because there was quite a simple change that was needed to Jordan's system, which was not to use evidence of torture. And I guess they could trust, for some reason, Jordan not to do that. But here, the Supreme Court found, they've made a factual finding that they cannot, that Rwanda has reneged on a very similar treaty with Israel. So if you read, the Lord Chief Justice, his dissent in the Court of Appeal effectively says, I cannot believe that two states like Rwanda and the UK would not comply with a treaty like this, given the financial, the reputational and all of that, all of the incentives. And the Supreme Court has just said that's nonsense. So unless they change the actual facts on the ground, the treaty is kind of window dressing.
I mean, the idea that you can change facts by passing an act of parliament seems to me to be verging on the Orwellian. The Bar Council, Nick Vineal, the chair of the Bar Council, put out a very good statement yesterday, I think. Can I just read briefly from it? Because I think it sums it up in a nutshell. This morning's Supreme Court decision upheld the principle that a scheme like the proposed Rwanda scheme could be lawful so long as, a matter of fact, Rwanda was a country to which refugees could be returned without there being a risk that refugees would be returned from there to the country from which they were fleeing. That's refoulement, obviously. The Supreme Court held that the Court of Appeal had been right to decide that Rwanda was not such a country. The Supreme Court decision therefore turns on a question of fact. If Parliament were to pass legislation, the effect of which was to reverse a finding of fact made by a court of competent jurisdiction, that would raise profound and important questions about the respective role of the courts and Parliament in countries that subscribe to the rule of law. I mean, that really is it in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Although I can't see that succeed. I think that is just a non-starter, because the courts, unless you exclude the courts entirely, they're just going to see through it. And I think that the more interesting question really is whether they're going to try and exclude the operation of
the Human Rights Act
yeah. and other protections.
Pausing there, Adam. That's this Suella idea of the notwithstanding clause, which she was floating this idea before she left the scene, that you could have an act of parliament that would say, notwithstanding the obligations under Section 6 of the Human Rights Act to act compatibly, etc., etc., we're going to remove people.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know whether that something like that could ever work. I mean, I was thinking about it this morning before coming on, and what you would, if just on the Human Rights Act point, you would end up with two statutes that conflict with each other, because the Human Rights Act gives universal protection to everybody, and then you've got this other statute that tries to exclude the protection from certain very vulnerable groups, and particularly the protection against the right to torture and inhuman and degrading treatment, which is the issue in this case. And I'm thinking, well, wouldn't that then lead to a use of the interpretative principle under Section 3 of the Human Rights Act? Because if you've got you've got one of the Acts of Parliament has a strong interpretative principle attached to it, why would, and also that is a constitutional statute, whatever that means, but it's been described by Lord Sumption and others as one. I'm not sure the courts would necessarily agree with that being excluded in this context.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I think if the real question is, would Parliament ever pass such an act, and could it ever get through the Lords? And I want to ask Ken about that in a second. But if you got such a piece of primary legislation on the statute book, I mean, the courts, the most they could do would be make a declaration of incompatibility. They wouldn't be able to strike it down.
I mean, I think it's in quite interesting constitutional territory, because they're not amending the Human Rights Act. You know, if you think about this, the principle of legality point, that Parliament has to squarely face up to what it's doing, and Parliament, if it could easily amend the Human Rights Act, and that would be the end of the domestic law point. But if Parliament chooses not to amend the Human Rights Act, but to enact conflicting legislation, I think there's at least a question about what would happen in that scenario. But I'm also interested to hear what the Lords will do.
Yeah, we'll come on to it. I'm going to ask Ken about that in a second. But of course, even if you manage to resolve this problem in the short term domestically, I mean, unless you withdraw from the European Convention on Human Rights, you don't get rid of the problem of Britain being taken to the European Court of Human Rights. But Ken, Lord MacDonald of River Glavan, just talk us through what you think the reception would be likely to be in the House of Lords to this type of legislation and the timetable.
I can tell you what the reception is in the Daily Mail, because there's a headline in the Mail today that says there will be fury! Unelected Lords plot to block the Rwanda law, and that constitutional. Expert Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg is quoted as saying that the Lords are planning to block the will of the people, as he put it. That's very familiar language.
Is that what you're up to, Ken, at the moment?
That's called fulfilling our constitutional destiny, I think. But this is going to be very, very bumpy in the House of Lords. There's no doubt about that at all. But because of the very reasons we've been describing, I think any statute that was intended to change facts on the ground by simply stating them to be other than they've been found by the country's highest court is going to be received with great skepticism, I think, and I think it would be very, very difficult for the Lords if Labour decide to oppose this legislation, it would be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for them to get this through the chamber. And I think they know that. Of course, they can use emergency procedures, so this is all speeded up dramatically. I mean, it can go through in a matter of days if they really want to push it. But they're going to have trouble getting a majority. I don't think they will get a majority. And I think people will feel very, very strongly that this is a government stepping out of constitutional line and defying the courts in a way that is political and inappropriate.
I mean, of course, it wouldn't be a manifesto commitment. So the House of Lords could block it and they'd have to use the Parliament Act procedure. I mean, wouldn't that mean it would take at least a year?
Yeah, there's an attempt by the government to say that because they, I've seen a minister comment to this effect, that because they had controlling immigration in their manifesto, this would somehow be covered by that. But I do think that my colleagues would be rather sceptical that that's an argument that works. So you're right, there could be, we could be looking at the Parliament Act and we could be looking at delay if that's the way the cards fall. But yes, certainly a very, very bumpy ride for the government, rightly, I think, because the House of Lords does see part of its job as being to sort of protect the constitutional niceties, particularly when governments are going a bit off leash, as this one seems to be on this question.
But I would have thought politically the ultimate point is that then whatever happens, they're not going to be able to do this before the next election.
Yeah.
Whether it's because there's going to be there's legislation and then a court challenge, or there is legislation which is delayed. There's no way that they're going to get flights off the ground by May next year, for example.
And can we just remind ourselves, Adam, before we finish, that the referendums have only made provision for 200 people.
Yeah.
We're talking here about a backlog of 86,000, tens and tens of thousands. I can't remember the exact number, but we're talking here about a policy that looks entirely performative and which, as you say, is unlikely to be performed, in fact, anytime soon.
It was a shock and awe policy. That's the point of the policy, is to scare people who are going to come to the UK. That's the stated aim of it. It's not to send all our asylum seekers to Rwanda. It's to stop it's to disincentivize people who are coming to the UK. And that's the fundamentally what it's about.
Well, Adam, many thanks for joining us on this emergency episode. It looks like there's unanimity here that Suella Braverman's dream of numerous planes taking off from the UK to drop asylum seekers off in Rwanda will remain a fantasy. Time will tell.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks for joining us, Adam. And in finishing, can I just remind us all that the new Home Secretary, James Cleverly, appeared on the Today programme a couple of days ago and notably failed to deny a suggestion by his interviewer that before he'd become Home Secretary, he described this policy as batshit. Thanks for joining us, Adam. You've been listening to a special episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with Tim Owen and me, Ken McDonald. Please do follow us, share our link, leave us a review. We'll be back very soon, and we look forward to seeing you then.